Wow. Nice voice.
Welcome everyone to System Thinking Ontario for March. We are going to have the usual procedure as we have been before. We'll go around and have everyone introduce themselves. I'm actually going to cover some of the content that I put up on the website as a way of priming us towards talking about entropy. And then we'll have David Hawk make some comments. He has some history with it. And I admitted before that, and I sent out in the note that I feel very consciously incompetent about entropy. I learned about it when I was going to the ISSS meetings, never really understood it, read some more, never really understood it. Not sure if I ever understood it, but I'm not sure if anyone actually ever does really understand it. So if this is new to you, you're not very far behind everybody else. And we'll have a great discussion, and hopefully Dave will clarify all that. So let's go around, and I think the question for the day will be, we'll have people answer the question, do you know anything about entropy, or what's your exposure to it, or do you have any opinions on it? And let me just open up the chat here, and I'll go through a list of people, participants. Gary, say hi.
Hi. So I'm Gary Metcalf. I'm mostly live in Kentucky in the U.S. And in Atlanta part-time. And I'm just looking for a good explanation about why I get more disordered as I age.
So. Thanks, Gary. Stephen, not Stillette. I'm going down to order here. So Stephen Stillette, we'll get to later. Stephen.
Theo Ragazzi.
Ah,
is that welcome. Me?
That's you. Glad to see you.
I'm so glad. Thank you, David, for organizing these meetings. I really think it's wonderful, and we are very grateful to you, truly, year after year. I'm a mathematician, physicist by background, professor at Trent University, now professor emeritus, and I am really not interested in entropy. I am interested in negentropy, because negentropy is the good stuff and entropy is the bad stuff. And one of the fundamental mistakes is trying to identify the negentropy-entropy distinction with order and disorder. That truly confuses things. So if you didn't understand it, you were correct and you showed good judgment. So the point about negentropy is the third law of thermodynamics. The third law of thermodynamics says that life is maintained by eating negentropy. Now, the third law of thermodynamics was stated by Schrödinger, and I really wouldn't want to argue against Schrödinger. So how's that for an introduction to the session?
That's like more than I can handle. So thank you, Stephen. And I'm sure we're going to have a lively discussion later.
Great, great.
Elena, say hi.
Hi, I'm here in Toronto. And I guess I first ran into entropy reading Wiener's Human Use of Human Beings about statistical mechanics. And then, of course, there's the physics side. About, you know, my copy getting cold. But what I'm most interested right now is this characterization of disinformation as deliberately feeding entropy into the public discourse. And I'm kind of interested in finding out if anybody else thinks that might be an insight.
Thanks, Elena. Emily.
Hey folks, I am also in Toronto. I'm an SFI alumni and I took systems thinking with Peter. Hi Peter, long time. Peter was also my MRP advisor. I'm currently on maternity leave, so I'm looking forward to, my husband is with the baby, I'm looking forward to not thinking about baby things for at least a few hours. And I first encountered entropy in my undergrad chemistry courses, and it's been a while since then, so looking forward to diving into this together.
Thanks, Emily. Griff.
Hey, everyone. Good evening, Griff. I'm coming in from Guelph, Ontario this evening, and I've been around with systems thinking for a couple of years. I would say at the moment, I am entropy agnostic.
That's a good way of driving it. Thanks.
Okay, David.
Jeff.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jeff Wheeldon, and I live in Brighton, Ontario. And I'm a systems thinker and a friend of a few SFI alum, and so they passed this on to me.
Thanks. Jonathan.
I am Jonathan, and I'm connecting for the first time with this group, and I'm based in Geneva in Switzerland, so it's actually quite late for me here. And I'm very pleased to finally be able to take part. I might not stay till the end if it goes on too long. Very happy to be here. I've training as a physicist, and I've been interested in causality and decision making for various reasons, which I'll not get into. And I've been very interested through this in to questions of emergence and reconnected with entropy also myself. And so this is a topic that I'm quite interested in.
Thanks for joining us in the distance. And yes, it's quite late where you are. Joshua.
Hi, everyone. I'm a pretty blank slate on entropy. I don't have a science background per se, and just general interest in the topic. And but have been attending the odd Systems Thinking Ontario event for a couple of years now. Thanks. And I'm in Toronto.
Thanks. Kelly?
Hey, I'm Kelly. I'm also coming in from Toronto. I'm just in the middle of transitioning from Alberta to Hamilton, but back in Toronto now. So as far as background, I come from a change background and just trying to catch up on entropy, lots through David Hawk in terms of just threads of information that I don't know that I've woven together yet, but I don't know whether it's part of the reason why I'd be considered a troublemaker because I'm looking in change.
Thanks. Michael.
Hello, everyone. I'm Michael. Live in Guelph, but I'm calling in from Kingston tonight. I'm a practicing engineer, so I encountered entropy as part of my thermodynamics training. Recent SFI alumni. I'm looking forward to the discussion tonight.
Thanks. Peter.
I'm Peter Jones, professor in the SFI program that's been mentioned. And I'm interested in entropy and order creation and order creation formation of systems of order as a process of design, but also in emergent social structures such as economies, which can be thought of when working with the inputs that are put into economies as far from equilibrium systems. That is, they don't operate at an equilibrium. They're open systems requiring a lot of energy to keep going. And I'm interested in David Hawk's interpretations, because consider him one of the kind of maybe clearest, I don't know about other living interpreters of Georgescu, Rogen, but you're one of the clearest interpreters of Nicolas Georgescu, Rogen. So interested in the discussion.
Thanks, Peter. Petri, who has been sending Instagram photos of Lake Superior.
Yeah, that's a frozen wasteland that looks like Planet Hoth right now. Yeah, that's where I am. That's just out my window, actually. So I'm in Gooley River. I'm an AI systems designer. I'm interested in all this stuff. Nice to see you all.
Thanks.
I miss Robert. Toronto.
Robert, if he's not carrying a baby.
Sure, I'm here. Actually, I was going to try and make a joke about neg entropy and having twins on the way. I don't know if I did that or not, but yeah, I'm in the Toronto, general Toronto area, Markham. I studied mechanical engineering. So I guess I bumped into some thermodynamics concepts there, but I'm still holding on to some lots of interesting questions, how energy relates to information and things like Maxwell's demon and these things. But more questions than answers, but happy to be here. Thanks.
Thanks. Rose.
Yeah, hi, I'm in Toronto, and I guess I first came to entropy through, like Michael, physics training. And I think I first became aware of it as the driver of order and creativity from a book I read years ago called Into the Cool, and have been interested in that ever since, and certainly with the connection to ecological economics. And I love this topic. I suggested it a few years ago, which led to David Mallory doing a talk. But I'm really looking forward to what David has to say tonight.
Thanks. If Rose has read Into the Cool, she's ahead of all of us. Stephen Sillett.
Hello. Thanks. Yeah, I'm in Toronto as well. I did get introduced. I did physical chemistry in my undergrad, but I thought that was one part of my world that I'd didn't have to worry about. And then I suddenly found this came up again because I've been getting into multi-scale systems work and active inference. So basically the idea of variational free energy, because originally when I'd done entropy, it was all about equilibrium states, equilibrium state before, equilibrium state after, what's the entropy between. But the bit in the middle was a bit of a black box and no one knew what was going on. So if you've now got dynamic systems, now you actually need to work with variational entropy to extract information. So yeah, I've been getting involved with that and the active inference lab. So they work a lot with entropy in different guises, or they're trying to, but again, a lot of questions. thanks
Stephen. Tim, say hi.
Hey there, Tim. I'm in Toronto. Nice to see everybody. And yeah, big fan of entropy, always enjoy chatting about how that maps onto these broader topics. Look forward to it.
Thanks. Umar in the UK.
Hi, guys. My second time here. I'm from Peterborough, UK. I work as a Scrum Master, but then it kind of puts me in the agile workspace and change management. And that's where my interest in systems thinking comes. And your group has been very interesting and interesting topics. Just here to learn.
Thanks. William.
Hi, all. It's been a long time since I've joined one of these meetings. William, also from Toronto, currently design researcher at Yelp. And my exposure to entropy, you know, as a kid, I was just obsessed with trying to figure out a way to create perpetual motion. And believe me, I really tried. Then I started studying mechanical engineering, where I learned that, that we can't really create perpetual motion. So I was exposed to the study of entropy as well. From the perspective of mechanical systems, I remember looking at the entropy equations and thinking about how that might well be the equation that describes the passage of time, to the point where I almost got that tattooed to remind myself that time is supposedly irreversible. But anyway, I digress. Then I started the SFI program, also with Peter. Hi, Peter. And feeling enlightened by being exposed to system studies and system dynamics. And I started reflecting on energy exchanges across systems, mechanical and non-mechanical, such as economic systems, social systems, and others. Yeah. Happy to see everyone again.
Thanks.
Yes, I'm next.
Yeah, I've been working alphabetically, so you're last.
I couldn't have them. This reminds me of my childhood when the teacher would go through the list of students alphabetically. I knew I could tune out for a long time. I'm a graduate of the SFI program, and I came to Simplicity Ontario through introduced through Peter, etc. I have very little exposure to entropy or knowledge about it, but from what I understand, it might be interesting if there's a discussion points that cover off kind of what Elena and Peter were talking about. Elena from the information, Peter from the organizational structure, system organization structure. I'm curious to know, like, entropy and civilization unit of analysis, because I'm just interested in the cycles between that.
And our host, Dan, you want to say hi?
Just wanted to actually
just say hi to Stephen R. I guess I don't know how to say his last name. The last time I saw him, we were at the CSI building, David. It was a snowstorm, and Stephen and I were on the streetcar, Spania streetcar, trying to get home. I don't know if he remembers that, but that was a lot of fun. So
that was one of the most wonderful conversations of my life.
Oh gosh!
And okay. I would like to thank you very much for that streetcar ride.
So, sort of following on the long topic of Stephen's interest in neg entropy, I'm also interested in that area. But another area I'm trying to get a sense of is all the work that David Ng's doing on yin and yang. I'm trying to figure out if entropy has anything to do with that. So I'll be waiting to figure that out. Thank you.
That's tough questions. Don just joined us. Don, do you want to say hi?
Hi. Oh, dear. Sorry about the video thing. Here we go. Yes, you want me to introduce myself?
Yeah, the question is, do you know entropy?
Right. Yeah, a dismal subject. Yeah, of course, like anyone who's interested in general subjects of such a sort, without any real knowledge of physics, I've always been interested in it, and I'm wondering if, from a systems perspective, there are more options to think, other ways to think about entropy. Well, I guess that's why I tuned in.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
So I'm going to share my screen again, just briefly, and share, and go back and just do a quick review of what I posted on the System Thinking Ontario screen, because for those of us who are trying to get on the same page, we had this nice video that was available on the law of thermodynamics in the economy, which was, I thought, pretty good. It went from more of a social sense than it did from the usual physical senses. Mm-hmm. Then we went through these lists of pre-readings. So rather than put people actually through Nicholas or Jesse Rogan, there was a summary article that was available, and in effect, the question is, what happens when you actually look at the entropy law and you put it into economics? There's an article by Rogan that was in retrospect. So if you didn't read the original work, sometimes easier to read backwards. And so from here, I excerpted some of the stuff on classic thermodynamics and what he thought was different about that. Now, Peter Corning is a former president of the ISSS, and one of the reasons that this article goes deeper than I wanted to go, but I wanted to bring out that he talks about the confusion about various interpretations of second law over the years. And so this is kind of the problem I get into when I start seeing systems work, and then the topic of entropy comes up is, I'm never quite sure if the person actually understands what they're talking about or not. And so that's why I get a little scared on the topic, because it's kind of like, are they saying something that I don't understand, or do they not understand what they're saying? And then the last article was the, can degrowth be considered a policy option? And we get into the ecological economics and how that fits in. And then from David Hawk, in his 2019 book, I actually brought this quote that David had said: "Entropy, something I had no idea when I was first told, then began to understand on a second encounter, then I knew I would never understand it when I met it the third time, then not being able to ever get over it on the fourth encounter." And talked about Einstein and Hawking, and it's like, okay. So with that introduction, I'm going to throw it over to David Hawk. And welcome to ask, how do we get into entropy and how do we understand it and what do people get wrong?
Most important, how do we get out of it?
Okay.
Yeah. I'm David Hawk, sitting here in Iowa, just west of the Mississippi. If you have some idea of where that might be, I'm not sure I do, but I first encountered entropy in 1963. In my first physics class, when the instructor told me in class that I wasn't allowed to bring it up in class, That was one subject we would not be covering. There was no point to it, and I should never bring it up again. Thus, I brought it up at every class meeting we had. I would bring it up and ask him if he's still the same. And so I learned about entropy watching him and the class dissolve over the semester. I never quite got over that and went off on all kinds of tangents, one of which was in 75, the concept of entropy more or less took me off to a funny idea of climate change in 75. So I did a two-year research project that ended up in climate change. And of course, I was told that that's even dumber than entropy, that that certainly is a non-starter, et cetera, et cetera. And then for my PhD dissertation written in 78, after it was reviewed, I was eventually, after a year of review, was told that, okay, we're going to pass it, but you really have to get rid of that stuff on climate change, that that makes no sense. And then, of course, I knew climate change was worth looking at. That whenever I've told not to do something, of course, I know that's where you should look. Not too long ago, I was having a discussion with some company people I advised, and I pointed out that the essence of their marketing, and they market lots of products, the essence of their marketing is neg entropy. That everything they say and do in marketing is neg entropy. And they might sit and think about entropy. Anyway, based on that, entropy got upset with me because I was considered flirting with neg entropy. And that's a no-no. And so entropy removed the capital letters from my name. So now I'm stuck with only small letters to signify my name. So until I get rid of neg entropy, I won't be allowed to have capital D and have capital H back yet. But let's see. Maybe tonight I can be rectified again and go back the entropy route. Lots of stuff relative to entropy used in many ways. I never did particularly like the way it was used in cybernetics. I never quite was comfortable with it in the information world. But nonetheless, if it's useful there, why not? It's just a different construct. I was particularly enamored in the early 70s with Nicholas Georgescu-Rosen, in part because he was such a fascinating troublemaker. And I really enjoyed the trouble that he made. Became friends with him during that time. And then in, I think, 1983, I arranged for a workshop at my university at the time, which would focus on Rosen's work. And it would have economists from 10, 15 different nations attending this workshop to see where economics was going. And I wanted Rosen to be the centerpiece. Unfortunately, National Science Foundation was paying for it. They were footing the bill for the whole workshop, and it was their idea. And then when they found out Rosen was coming, they put a hold on the money and said, we can pay no money if Georgescu-Rosen is going to be sponsored at the meeting. And then I knew, wow, bingo. I knew Rosen was good then. If NSF thought he was questionable, man, that was, I was on a roll then. So then we arranged for other money to pay for him to come and house him. And we did have this workshop, which turned out rather nicely. And Rosen gave lots and lots of lectures during those 2 days, as did many other of the economists that were present. Based on that, we did a number of things, at least under his inspiration, when I was teaching at Iowa State University, I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that. It's someplace in Ames, Iowa. And I, unfortunately, had been a student there and graduated from the place. When I graduated, the engineering faculty gave me the award as the scariest student they ever had. And that was quite an award to get. That was the first and last year, I guess, it was ever given. And so nonetheless, I didn't have good relations, but a new dean at Iowa State heard that certain professors would resign if I was brought back to teach. And so he came down to the farm and convinced me to come back to teach. These four would resign, he said. And I thought, wow, what an opportunity to make it better. So I did go there and teach. And during that teaching, I did, off in the architecture department, I did what was called an entropy studio, meaning how do you bring the concept of entropy in the design of buildings? And I still loved it. I wasn't sure what it was. And the faculty, of course, well, whatever. But the students really liked it and really went whole hog into it. So much so that we were in this five-story, brand new, stretch skin glass building, of course, with no cross ventilation. And the students were learning more and more about thermodynamics. And they were wondering why we didn't have operable windows. So one night, the students took out the stretch skin windows and replaced them with Pella double hung windows. Anyway, the Des Moines Register had a heyday with it, destroying government property. Everyone on campus was angry. The president was really angry and somehow used the word entropy a lot. And I'm not sure how they meant it. I'm not sure how the studio meant it. But nonetheless, that became a crucial, shall we say, a red line. That was a no-no. Students should never be allowed to do things like that. So in the process of replacing the double-hung windows for cross-ventilation with the stretch-skin glass, the workmen of the university, of course, broke the glass. It was like 250-pound panes of glass, and they broke them. So then the students were charged with breaking government property, et cetera, et cetera. So the final conclusion of that, and there really is no conclusion, but the final conclusion was the student body in the School of Architecture built a three-story soybean straw baled house behind the design center to show as an example of what a house in the future would be like that would do less environmental damage. And it was a fantastic house. Anyway, the angry people got even angrier and went on and on. And the students were kicked out. And I was fired and sent off to better places. But nonetheless, if you have a chance to do an entropy design studio, don't do it. But it causes a lot of trouble and nobody understands what the hell you're doing anyway. In line with that, going back to Rosian, he was always quite helpful and I always appreciated him. And during his stay with me for that workshop, we did a joint paper, assuming it could never be published, and we were right. It was called Second Law Economics, and it was a paper of humor, much more than seriousness. I think maybe in another 10 years, it might be less humorous. Nonetheless, I always enjoyed working with him, laughing with him. Every year, I think I've mentioned this to a couple of you, but every year he would, as a Christmas present, send me his favorite unpublishable paper that year. And he was really excited about his unpublishable papers and quite liked the man. And sorry for his death. I hear it was a rather bad one. He died very lonesome. Least of which would be the Nobel Prize people that were angry at him every year, because the Asians would dominate him, Europeans would vote for him, and the Americans were unanimously against him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That went on for many years. Nonetheless, that only proved that he was onto something. Now, getting back to entropy, Rosian included materials along with energy. And so a number of the negative papers written against him and the negative reviews are how you can't do that. It's only for energy. Since then, there are sort of two reasons why he may have been right. One was during my two-year project in Sweden, we found with the paper companies that you can recycle paper only three times. Its quality degrades over time. You cannot recycle paper the fourth time. You simply have mush and there was no order in MUSH to turn out more paper. And so we documented and sent that out to the science community and said, what happens relative to entropy in this? Is there a relationship going on here? And the second thing having to do with some of the cutting edges of physics these days began to say that materials and energy are identical. That in essence, all of the fights we had over them being different may not have been accurate after all. So anyway, Roshan eventually is coming into good stead in spite of his tremendous enemies, and he had some tremendous enemies. Any questions about any of that? That's sort of a confused preamble. And the part you should remember is entropy took away my capitalized letters. It was not very nice of her. Him, I'm sorry. Okay. Him is neg entropy. Her is entropy. We all know that.
Stephen had posted a comment. Do you want to talk about that, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting thing with neg entropy, because if you've
with got... who, I'm sorry?
With neg entropy.
Okay.
Neg entropy is kind of how we interpret certain changes when energy drops in the system, because the reactants have gone to a product which has a lower energy configuration. So we say, okay, it's had neg entropy. But that's a kind of an average of where we were at the beginning and where we are at the end. If the process that goes between them is a statistical unfolding of a dynamical nature, then that statistical unfolding is ever only between zero and one. So strictly speaking, you can never actually get neg entropy in what happens in real time. It's just the product is lower entropic products. And if you're dealing with equilibrium states, that's what you have. You have reactants, which are, or your start point, which is an equilibrium, and you have your end point that's an equilibrium, and the bit in the middle is not talked about because no one. But if you do nonlinear dynamics, now you're in this realm of being in amongst all that, and it can only go between zero and one. It can't go negative.
So you believe neg entropy is possible?
No.
Okay.
I think it's statistically, you get the result of an entropic force which can push things in that direction. But in real time, it's a zero to one statistical process.
Any other questions or comments so far? Neg entropy is a lot of fun. You can have a lot of fun with it. With the company I was working with, which makes products, their advertising was implying that they would go forever. They would never need maintenance, never need service. They're infinitely long products. So customers should never worry about that. If you step back and look at the ads you see on TV, essentially every product they advertise is that way.
David, I wonder if I could just focus the discussion.
Yep.
That living organisms are systems.
Yep, like you and me.
Living organisms are lumps of negentropy.
They're what?
They are lumps of negentropy.
Boy, I hope so. I've been praying to God about that.
So the crucial point that perhaps we could focus on is photosynthesis, that in photosynthesis, somehow, the negentropic force of the sun coming in is turned into large molecules. So I want to dispel the mystery and look at something very concrete, which is the process of photosynthesis as the creation of large molecules which are rich in negentropy. So I'll just leave it at that for now, for the moment.
A major point of argument has to do with what is a closed system and what is an open system. And so at least the main definition of entropy deals with a closed system. So many argue, since we're in the solar system, we have this thing called the sun, then there's no such thing as a closed system, because the sun always brings energy into the earth. And so that is a particular point of view. The best person I've ever been around that would say that is wrong, in other words, clearly would say it was wrong, was Carl Sagan. That Carl Sagan in 1980, he and I put on a session at the World Futures Conference where we talked about entropy and negentropy in the universe. And he firmly believes that entropy controls the universe and will take us all the way to the end of the universe. But then he postulated, which I've mentioned before to a couple of you, he postulated that maybe at the end, it reverses itself. And then the entire universe is negentropy and entropy is gone. And he said, why not? But he said, the train we're on is the one headed for entropy, and that negentropy does not exist. It simply isn't there. So Carl Sagan.
Living organisms are lumps of negentropy. And the crucial point where I would focus is photosynthesis. And it's kind of cute, you know, that Sagan suddenly goes off into space when a discussion like that is to begin. It's interesting. Why does it go off into space when we are trying to talk about photosynthesis?
Boltzmann was big on this topic that you just mentioned. And Boltzmann, vis-a-vis statistics, could find negentropy whenever he wanted to. He was rather good at finding it. Rosen had lots of trouble with Boltzmann. It's interesting to read the two points of view.
It's interesting. When I think about Boltzmann, I always think about Robert Musil, der Mann ohne Eigenschaft, the man without qualities. And I kind of think of Boltzmann as summarizing the Austro-Hungarian Empire at that particular moment, which is random molecules bouncing around.
Yes, yes.
I'm sorry. I want to go back to photosynthesis. Do we have a single biologist in the room? If we are systems thinkers, how come we are not thinking about living systems? And that's a genuine question of mine. It is not a rhetoric question. I really would like people to chip in and let us know about your experience with biology. The third law of thermodynamics says that life is maintained by eating negentropy. I am alive every single day because I keep eating negentropy. Same thing happens to you. And there's nothing mysterious about either entropy or negentropy. It's just a physical quantity. It's a physical quantity like temperature. So entropy can be high, entropy can be low. Negentropy can be high, negentropy can be low. So the question is this. Do we have anybody in this particular group who has a biology background?
I think they died. It's a joke, sorry. There are two camps that argue for negentropy. One is the camp you mentioned, which argues that life is the source of negentropy. The other camp argues that information is a source of negentropy. And around each are the people that primarily have degrees in those subjects.
So, David, my introduction, I guess, to this negentropy concept was somehow related to the question of order, right? So if entropy is an increasing dissolution of order, everything is going back to some, you know, the universe goes back towards a heat death. There is nothing organized anymore.
Right.
Negentropy somehow tried to explain, so then how do things get more ordered?
Right.
like becoming living organisms. And that may be the bridge to what Stephen's talking about. You know, this and that. So negentropy was somehow this placeholder. It began to somehow explain within, and obviously then energy comes in so that, you know, something, energy is required in order to produce more order. But maybe I don't have all that straight.
As straight as anybody. It's a tough one that, I mean, even my quite religious friends enjoy talking about entropy. And so for them, entropy is hell. Negentropy is heaven. And so if you put enough energy into it, you'll end up in heaven. And finally, you'll have negentropy. They don't like the idea that entropy affects life and people die. That's just a dumb idea. Because everybody knows people don't die. Life goes on. Et cetera, et cetera.
Stephen Sillette.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. It's always tricky when things get scaled, but in terms of like entropy, it's like, it's like a flowing river. You can't bottle it. It's not a thing. So for instance, if I saw, actually it was on the post that you said how it could be called uncertainty. So can you have negative uncertainty? You see, this is the question. That's what I'm saying. It's like, so the question is, what you can have is a variation from the maximum uncertainty and complexity of variation, and you can have a bound on that. You can have variation in that, but it never goes below zero in real time. Now, by fluctuating the amount of uncertainty, you can then start to gain insights into how something is. You can get information out of that. Because the amount of uncertainty, how much it varies, can give you an indication of how close you are to something. So what they use in active inference is they talk about informational free energy as opposed to thermodynamic free energy. And then you get into a slightly different game. But like I say, in real time, then your uncertainty can't become negative. But it can become a force in thermodynamics to drive, like water becomes ice, and then there's a negentropy process. You could call it negentropy, but it just means it's forced it into a state which is in a higher energy configuration, and therefore it takes heat out of the system because the energy's gone into the molecules and it's got locked. Because statistically it's done that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that any point in time, the process that's driving it is essentially negative.
Let's go back to Clausius, right? Clausius looks at the first law of thermodynamics, energy is conserved. Clausius looks at the steam engine. Clausius, being German, is thorough. He says, energy is not conserved. Energy degrades. Right? That's how it happened. And he said, you put in energy, which is high quality, and you get out work, which is high quality, and then you get waste heat, which is low quality. And the poor man, again being German, focuses on low quality energy. And he has to have a name for low quality energy. And he calls low quality energy high entropy. And the poor man doesn't notice that it's the work that's important. In other words, the high quality energy output that's important. In other words, work. And did not concentrate on the good stuff. He concentrated on the bad stuff. And then for 100 years, 150 years afterwards, we kept concentrating on the crap, which is entropy, which is low quality energy. So physicists, being insensitive to language, don't notice that the first law of thermodynamics is contradicted by the second law of thermodynamics. The first law says energy is conserved. The second law says energy is not conserved. Energy degrades. The third law of thermodynamics is what's interesting because it talks about living systems. Life is maintained by eating negentropy. In other words, when you are putting food in your mouth, you are absorbing high quality molecules. And if you focus on high quality molecules, you focus on photosynthesis, because it is at photosynthesis where the high quality molecules are absorbed.
Are you aware of the work of Eunice Foote, F-O-O-T-E?
You got me.
At the same time, in 1856, same time,
yes,
she took issue with that thesis and argued that more important is probably that waste stuff that goes off. And so she put together a model that if you don't worry about the production process, or you don't worry about the crap and the low energy, as well as the gases that come off of it, you're headed for trouble. And she articulated that in the process, you create carbon dioxide.
What was Foote's ethnicity?
Foote, F-O-O-T-E is her last name.
What was the ethnicity?
I'm not sure, but she was born in the U.S., I think, upstate New York.
I mean, it's a fairly reasonable thing, you know.
Yep.
If you don't pay attention to washing the dishes, the household disintegrates. Well, washing dishes is very important. You want to know what's important about marriage? What's important about marriage is who washes the dishes.
Yep. So, or the divorce.
Focusing on entropy, I believe, is very important. Focusing exclusively on entropy is strange.
Anyway, she did a paper on this in 1856. And
thank you very much. I'm going to follow up on that. That's very
and she couldn't couldn't present it to AAAS. So she had the man sitting next to her present it, because women weren't presenting back then.
Yeah.
And they just thought about weird stuff.
Yeah. Is anybody familiar with Gibbs free energy?
Yep.
Tell us about it, please.
Anyway, relative
free energy.
Yes, I understand. I mean, I'm quite sold on the entropy construct because of climate change. And it's a terribly good doorway into climate change, which most people don't see the connection, but most people don't see climate change either.
I agree with you. In 1972, I was lecturing in a mathematics course at the University of Toronto, and Limits to Growth came out. And I immediately brought the material into lecture. And I said, you know what mathematics is about? It's predicting how humanity is going to kill itself. Mm. So yeah, I'm fully with you when it comes to, you know, early detection of generating pollution, and pollution does all sorts of interesting things. But still, I'm kind of wondering about as to why people did not run with things like Gibbs free energy.
Maybe you can't sell it.
Good point. Can't disagree with you on that.
Yes, this new book I have coming out, which David had mentioned, I think the name is rather appropriate: short-term gain, long-term pain. And that's mostly what drives humans, and including scientists, et cetera, that in essence, we are into the short-term gain. And so within the book, I describe it as part of the Faustian bargain that we humans make, and it leads to the Faustian tragedy. And for those that have trouble with Faust, they wouldn't like the book. those that understand the tragedy would be more interested. But it goes through climate change in some detail on how it's all a Faustian bargain. And most of us sort of know it's going badly. We just spend a lot of time thinking it isn't. Come on, guys, say something. Girls, doggies, kitties, somebody.
I would call on Rose if she actually could remember enough of Into the Cool to make a comment. Within the ISSS, one of the people that was working in this area cited is actually James Kay, who was involved with the work with Eric Schneider. And so I never had the benefit. I just met him briefly in a conversation, but I never had the actual opportunity to interact with him. So Rose, did you want to comment on what you actually learned from Into the Cool?
I'd be happy to do that. There is a question in the chat about, it suggests looking at that as well. But I guess with respect, the main thing I remember is just an in-depth look at, dissipative structures. When I think of entropy, I think of it as a driver of creativity because a dissipative structure is more complex than its surroundings, and it's created to dissipate energy, that is to create greater entropy, but it is itself a more complex structure. So there's just that relationship that it's both getting more, the entire system, the boundary of the system overall is more disordered, but within it, there's increased complexity of the structure. That was my big takeaway, and it really affected how, for example, models of the economy and whether things like cradle to cradle in terms of can not just recycling, but will the material loops work were problematic initially. But I guess the other thing that comes, and this is not so much in the book, but different kinds of complexity, like internal complexity, external complexity, and how you, I'm going to stop there.
Thanks, Rose. David, do you have a comment on that?
I tend to avoid the order-disorder aspect because that's not part of the original definition. And I sort of don't need it relative to climate change issues. But in essence, it's more that you do something and a price will be paid for doing that. And so my concern is with the things that we do that a price will be paid for. So, of course, much of the stuff, the industrial system turns out, is quite fine, necessary, essential, whatever. But a lot of it is pure junk. And so there's an awful lot of what we do under industrialization that's based mainly on funny wants and not bio needs. And the what's for billionaire life is sort of a discussion. So in doing that, I avoid the disorder order constructs, which information people, of course, use. That IT is very much wedded to order disorder because of the cybernetics, Shannon, et cetera. That direction and simply talk about a decorative quality. And so is it worth it? Was it worth it? And logical economics group, even though in many public founded it or the spirit behind it, whatever, he had nothing to do with it. But he, his expression when he first heard about it was, someday you will see ecology eat economics. And so there's not much more to say. So in other words, the order disorder is sort of a tangent that's much more for IT and probably not for physics, probably not biology, probably not climate change issues. I don't know. That's my feeling, so I sort of avoid it. But you still use the terms, but I'm not sure disorder is entropy. It just, there's a qualitative difference, which is, I'm not sure I would measure it by disorder. I mean, everyone that opposes me has disordered thoughts. And everyone that agrees with me has a very tight, orderly system. That's all I know for sure, David.
Could I just hasten to agree with that? Is that there are many different ways of increasing entropy. And one way of increasing entropy is dilution. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're not generating disorder. You're just generating stuff that's more dispersed, kind of runs off into the space of gone. So
exactly,
I wanna affirm that you're definitely thinking in the right directions. It was a mistake to identify the negentropy entropy distinction with order and disorder.
I agree with that. It's a tangent.
And the other part difficulty is that we understand entropy much better than we understand disorder or order.
That's true. That's true. So I'm not sure entropy is something you can go to a loan officer and get a loan with, but at least one of you should try it. Let's see how it goes. There really are people that have gone to banks with a basis to create neg entropy. They've actually presented that at the bank and got a loan. That has been certified. And in addition, in the early 1930s, enough people had done that that the federal government passed a law saying it is illegal to patent neg entropy. In the United States of America, when you find neg entropy, you are not allowed to patent it. It needs to be available for everyone without a patent. And so at least our representatives in Congress were taking good care of us back then. And so, if you invent it, you can't patent it. Sorry.
In the chat, Emily had asked about elaborating on entropy and climate change. Emily, was there a particular direction you wanted to go with that?
Yeah, thanks, David. And David, for your provocations. I'm interested in, I guess, David Hawk, you've been looking at this connection between entropy and climate change, I think you said since the 70s. And so I'd be interested in how maybe your perspective has changed or maybe hasn't changed. If you could just elaborate that, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, it really hasn't changed. All four of my wives left me. They gave up and said, it's hopeless. And they went away. And so it's hard to convince me of much of anything anymore. No, more seriously, the perception is more or less the same. In my climate change project, it's worth noting that there were 20 companies and 6 governments that asked to join, except one company I asked. Then the rest all joined this project that was trying to understand environmental deterioration, where it came from, and was climate change an issue. And so I worked with those 6 governments and 20 companies, where the companies include the major petrochemical companies and chemical companies on the planet. So Texaco, Exxon, et cetera, et cetera. And so during the 70s, when we were coming to some sense of results in this project, and I spent 2 years going through their plants, refineries, talking to people, interviewing people, that, if you saw a problem relative to environmental degradation from something you were doing as a result, what would you do about it? And there we found that the workmen had a better idea of what to do about it than the CEO or managers back at head office. They had very little idea. It was amazing how much more workmen knew. Nonetheless, in lots of meetings, we more or less convinced them that climate change was important, environmental deterioration was important, and Exxon was even having a discussion of how to look at alternative energy sources. Can you believe that? In the 70s. The CEO of the time was thinking of doing that. And then this Dr. Black, one of their chief scientists, came out with a remarkable paper on climate change and the production of Exxon. And so he was one of the keynote people in climate change that was in this project and wrote something quite sterling. And he was presenting it to the board as part of my project. And the corporate lawyer from Exxon interrupted him and asked him to please stop talking. That if you go on, then Exxon is going to be seen as culpable for this thing you call climate change. So it's best if you just shut up. And so a corporate lawyer trained in a US law school was the leverage with which Exxon began to be a little scared of what it was saying about what it was doing. Then they got a new CEO, of course, from Texas, who brought things back on track. And then Exxon went off to the stars with carbon dioxide. But indeed, back in the 70s, there was some hope. And so indeed, things can change. And sometimes they do. But right now, I don't think the body politic is there. I don't think the consumer is there. I think the consumers are still buying a lot of this trash turned out by industrialization that nobody needs, probably nobody wants, and it's just stored up. And we still build buildings trashy, badly, ugly. As a small footnote on that, when I would teach architecture classes, I would teach classes that the great enemy of architecture is Euclid. If you could dump Euclid, you'd be home free. And the worst thing about Euclid is law, I think it's number 5, the law of parallels. If you could just get rid of parallels in your building design, you'd have fantastic creations that humans would like, think well, and live well. Parallels is what screws up the mental brain. And so please design something with no parallel lines. Based on this, an architect in Finland designed a building called Dipoli. Beside student center, the architect designed it in order to get less and be less drunk. And so if you design this building to be fantastic to be in and feel sort of drunk, you don't need to drink so much. And he was right. It's a fantastic student center. And they started having some advanced engineering courses in some of the rooms in Dipoli. And they turned out amazingly well for getting engineers to leave business as usual and go to business as unusual. It was a basis for creativity, these non-parallel rooms. Finally, engineers took it over and kicked most of the students out because it was too successful. Anyway, there's never been another building quite like that until recently in China. In 2017, a new library was built in a new town, which tried its best to get rid of parallels. And this is a library I've shown you quite often, David. Beautiful, beautiful building. It was specifically designed to try and get rid of Euclid's parallel lines. So we could certainly make much better products with industrialization. But the stuff we're building is, I mean, my God, why do we do it? Why do we buy it? We don't use it. We don't consume it. It sits around, becomes garbage, taken away to a dump or thrown in the ocean. And it just goes on and on and on. So it has to do with the entropy argument relative to getting business as usual to stop doing what it's doing and simply look for business as unusual and make different things, fewer of them, that actually means something. So if nothing else, think about architecture. Next time you're in a room with parallel walls, it's a joke. Think about Euclid and what he did to you. You probably know in nature, there are no parallel lines. Nature had a better idea. Anyway, now I begin to swear. So I'm going to shut up because I don't want to swear just now. David, don't tell them the name of my third book.
I think we'll move on to a comment that Jonathan was making on Ashby. Did you want to bring that up, Jonathan?
Why not? It was a bit out of place, I think, in the end, because it took me some time to type it out. It's my first time attending, so I'm not quite sure how to approach the discussion. And if there's some specific themes that we have to go for. But anyway, my question is basically goes back to how I got back into studying entropy about 3-4 years ago more thoroughly. I've now forgotten most of it, but I was just trying to remember how I had gotten back into it. And there's this article about on self-organization written by Ross Ashby. And there was something very interesting in there that he talks about a very simple idea for self-organizing systems. And I was interested in this because I was interested in understanding how people make decisions and where goals come from. And one of the ideas is that goals are kind of a self-organizing phenomenon. And in this article, he says something that I found very surprising, and actually I've still not really understood it. And it's this sentence I've written here. So, every isolated determinate dynamic system obeying unchanging laws will develop organisms that are adapted to their environments. And he further says to explain this, and in fact, this is connected to cellular automata, is my understanding. And let me just share the rest of the text. In going from any state to one of the equilibria. So that was his whole thing, was looking at dynamic systems, Ashby a lot. The system is going from a large number of states to a smaller. In this way, it is performing a selection in the purely objective sense that it rejects some states by leaving them and retains some other state by sticking to it. So basically, he's considering a non-ergodic system. And in such a system, he's saying, okay, you have self-organization. And he talks about an isolated determinate dynamic system. And I always, I remember when I read this, I thought this is weird because for me in a closed system from physics, we know that entropy either stays the same or increases. It can't decrease. But here we're talking about a decrease in entropy in this particular example. And I've never really been able to make sense of this because both versions kind of make, and I think you end up getting into Maxwell's demon kind of issues here, and you start looking into so for example, for cellular automata, it's not necessarily true that entropy has to go up. If you have a periodic cellular automata, obviously the entropy will maybe go up at some point and then go back down to where it was before. So this notion that entropy has to increase is not so obvious. And I've never actually I kind of dropped it because I never was able to understand this, but I think there's something quite deep and interesting there. Anyway, I was just throwing that out there to see if anyone had anything interesting to say about this.
In fact, that's really mainstream. That's not a tangent. That's terribly important for a lot of people working in the entropy area. I don't know if you know the name Eric Trist, Tavistock Institute.
I don't.
But in essence, their work on the self-organizing group, or they call it the autonomous work group, came out of the discussion, just like what you said. And Eric was my thesis advisor for the climate change work back in the 70s. But later I found that in essence, his ideas on self-organization came very much from the Russian Kropotkin, who worried about these things back in the early 20th century. The idea of the self-organizing group to compensate for things getting bad or turning bad. But in essence, how to get beyond leadership to go to self-organization in order to correct things. And the self-organizing group was something which came out of, I don't know, 20,000 BC, whatever. This idea of you don't need a leader, that the group as selves can organize themselves. And so in essence, the entropy argument was it sort of all goes to shit, whatever you do. But in essence, Kropotkin argued that you can go the opposite way relative to these humans that can defy that process. And then Trist set up many experiments to show that was true. So it was actually quite good stuff. And it certainly included the term entropy within their argumentation. And so it's certainly there. So just because entropy is taking place in the larger system doesn't mean you can't play with the neg entropy relative to the social systems. And indeed, you need to. But to have a leader, say, of 10,000 people is not the way to work against entropy. That guarantees entropy wins. That it must be self-regulation, self-organization. Because that is where the order lies. And so indeed, they went through what you just talked about with some amazing results that are almost never applied because they're too successful when they're applied. It scares the hell out of management. Lots of examples if you're interested.
I mean, I think there are two different ways you can look at negentropy. I'm not an expert on negentropy, but as I understand it, a system that reduces its entropy can happen if you are an open system, which I think is what life and biology were talking about that previously. The common explanation is that it's an open system, so obviously the second law doesn't apply in this case. How exactly it all works, obviously, is still a mystery, but. The point that this Ashby is making, I thought, was interesting because it's quite a different argument. It's not about being an open system. Mm-hmm. It's a computational argument, much the same as what would make for cellular automatons. Mm-hmm. It's got nothing to do really with if the system's open or closed. It's just got to do with the fact that it's a digital computational system, and that's how I was I understood it anyway.
There might have to be a check there about whether it's a second law of thermodynamics or statistical entropy. I was taking a data science course in which we actually had to do information entropy, and the thing that was drilled into me is this is not the second law of thermodynamics.
Right,
it's a misnaming.
Right,
that is true. Although there is a connection that is made through, Szilard and all those guys that were working on Maxwell's demon, they definitely make a connection in specific systems between these two types of entropy and Landauer. Basically cheats a bit because he makes a connection by he basically says the that informational underlying informational entropy in the end he makes it such that he starts from the assumption that the second law is valid to make this. I'm not actually sure what that it's true. I've heard this argument also before that thermodynamic entropy and information entropy are not the same. Although I think you can make a connection. Anyone who's working on Maxwell demon type issues will make that connection.
If you'd like to go deeper in that, there is some good material. It began with the Hawking bet with some people at Caltech in I think 2003 until 2006. Where in essence, that was the argument and had to do with what happens when information goes into a black hole. And Hawking argued it's destroyed, it's gone. It cannot come out of the black hole. And the other two professors at Caltech argued that indeed you can retrieve information from the black hole. It is preserved, and so it is not subject to entropy. That in essence, it may not be neg entropy, but it preserves itself. And so indeed, 2 years later, Hawking finally gave in and said, well, I think you're right. And the prize was to give whoever won a year subscription to Sports Illustrated. So indeed, he gave that subscription to the two professors. And then a bit later, one of them wrote back and said, you should have torn it up in pieces before you sent it to us, that we would have understood it much better. Anyway, more recently, a couple of people have now argued again, maybe Hawking was right, that perhaps information cannot come out of a black hole. So it's a fascinating area to go into, but we sort of don't need that because we notice things dissipate anyway. And we notice that the environment is not very friendly to humans and living systems, regardless, even if they're following system sciences, which generally they're not. And so in essence, the topic of, shall we say, systems theory, system science, and deterioration, planet, life, many things, is still spot on. Whether we use entropy is an open subject. The reason it's open is because many do not like to see death connected to entropy. That's sort of a no-no. And so they either skip the issue or they pretend they're immortal and move on. And David, that's why I like that other book so much on immortality, The Pulitzer Prize winning book of 1974. That's a fantastic book if you're going to think about entropy in life. Good stuff.
We'll cover that next month, I think. Elena had actually injected a question. Is she still with us?
I'm still here. I was wondering about noise with relationship, particularly to climate change issues, because much of the information has been countered by opposite information, oblique information, et cetera, which seems to be intended to cause confusion. And I wondered if that was part of what you consider to be entropy or whether that's just nasty self-serving politics.
That's for me, that's just humans being human. And it's quite predictable, forecast, et cetera. And so indeed, going back to the Exxon meeting, indeed, the lawyer introduced that you know, there was no way to say the scientist was wrong, but at least he should shut up. And so indeed, he tried shutting up. Then he died not long after. That was Mr. Black or Dr. Black. So indeed, it's sort of human relations with each other, with nature, with whatever doesn't obey them, including their wives, that it's just human nature. You know that process. Doesn't have to be downhill, but it tends to be. That's why Denial of Death was such a good book. That in essence, the author considers that's the source of evil in the world.
Peter, you had a contribution here about Bob Logan's work.
Well, we actually haven't looked at Bob Logan's What is Information? It was supposed to be published by University of Toronto Press at one point, and Greg Van Alstyn and I took it on to publish it as an online book, but also self-published on Amazon. Logan developed this, you know, the concept that I think was originally formulated by Stuart Kaufman of the propagation of organization. That it's essentially a holistic information theory that applies to, I mean, and they don't make an argument for neg entropy, but they make an argument for the propagation of order through information and it came out of an argument that essentially the kind of standard physics, well, what we believe of standard physics sometimes doesn't apply in the biosphere and in observations, and this is a systems biology conference, and that biotic information does not follow the Shannon hypothesis of course, a lot of things don't, but, you know, the kind of underlying information theory based on bit transfer and information formulated as bits. And so it's a systems theory of information in biotic information, the symbolospheres, she essentially considers language in human exchange, the technosphere or computability, and the econosphere, and you'd say the way information is used to trade capital and real assets, and that these all bear commonality, is the attempt at kind of one of these, you know, it didn't develop all the math, but, you know, as a physicist, it was a kind of a strong position to take to integrate an information theory across the different domains that could start to explain relationships between language, computation, robotics, and the biosphere and economies through a new information theory that would take that into account. And you can read it online. It's actually written up in a really visually compelling way, very scrollable. But Bob has, you know, it also takes into account some McLuhanism. In other words, this is an attempt to create a new medium of in a sense, it's a medium of information that replaces Shannon or other information theories. So I wanted to just make people aware of that particular, I think, you know, the Stevens were talking about information and the relationship to, you know, biotic information. And there are kind of the arguments around negentropy. I'd recommend grappling with Logan's what is information.
Peter, could you just once again repeat the reference there?
Oh, it's in the chat. Yeah, what is information?
Yes.
By Robert Logan, is professor of physics at University of Toronto, emeritus now. He was connected to our strategic innovation lab for a while, and so we published
it. Right. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Also, Peter recommended Stuart Kaufman early in your comment, Peter. And
yeah, this
Stuart
is based
Kaufman
on...
you should take a look at also.
Yeah.
He's got half a dozen books. He's sort of a good friend of mine. Sometimes we almost have weekly chats or whatever, and he's sort of, I think he believes that life is negentropy, and that biology, et cetera, a little bit like Stephen was at, in terms of there's much more hope there than I would give it. And so he's a more optimistic person.
I have to confess that I used Stuart Kaufman's book as a textbook in my courses for 5 years.
Yep, I would too. He writes very well and he thinks very well, and on projects we argue a lot, and he tells a joke about me, not a joke, but true story, to many groups that I'm not at, and so my reputation has been somewhat diminished by a joke that involves some anyway, it's for presidents of universities that like sports. He describes me as an enemy of those people and why sports shouldn't be there. And he uses a part of the male anatomy to describe why those people have sports on campus. And I've now heard from quite a number of them that he uses that joke a lot. It had to do with a thing I did for getting fired, and I was in 5 different court cases around having made that comment. But Stuart laughs his way through that story, and some people have taped it and sent me copies, and so he's hard on me. He's he's not gentle. I like him much. He's very good.
Stephen Sillette, you've been posting various things in the chat.
Oh, yeah, I was just, in terms of the signal to noise, it could be argued that the signal noise is part of the signal in a way. So it's more the question becomes about how do you interpret the information in the signal when there's noise. But that assumes that there's something coming in, which it is in like radar, which Joshua mentioned. We have a signal that's coming in because we've got a dead system here where something comes in and we know what it is we're measuring. Mm-hmm. But the actual signal that's coming in, and you could always argue chemically, that's always entropic part of it. It's sending the stuff that we're going to interpret. The stuff that's bound up, that's now staying as potential energy, isn't accessible in terms of the reaction. It's always stuff that's dissipating that we can then access. The stuff that is still kept, is still keeping its energy and its potential energy, that's not what is the signal. So that's the first point, is you've got this signal. But then the second point is, in biological systems, we don't know what our signal, we have no way of knowing, organisms don't know what signals are coming in. They don't know, everything's random and dynamical and unknown. So it's about resolving uncertainty in all the randomness. So it's actually using stochastic noise and entropy to get at what might be out there for it to act in the world. That's the argument with sort of some of the work around active inference and the free energy principle, is it's through action that you resolve uncertainty, but you never know. You never have a signal coming in, you only have action. So it's like an interaction with which is very different to a signal, which is directly either got information or not. I don't know if that makes sense, but so in some ways we have to be careful that we don't mix the two up, because okay, we're organisms making stuff in the niche, which are radars and stuff, which use information and process information, and we're trying to interpret the information. But then what's happening for us as an organism is seen as more of an uncertainty resolving dynamical prediction process. That's the thinking anyway. And that's different. So there's no signal for me to read. Everything is noise that I'm trying to, or noise or random dynamical processes, which I get more and more purchase on and grip on through action.
What do you mean through action? Could you just inquire?
Yeah, so by acting, you either will see through least action. So with the free energy principle, it looks at complexity and accuracy, okay? So either the least complex approach to acting or the most accurate to meet my predictions will be the one which minimizes free energy the most. So you're forever trying to minimize or create actions which resolve uncertainty in the most plausible way. The complexity could be kind of like an entropy term, in terms of the less entropy in terms of how the action takes place, or the most accuracy in terms of how close it was to what we predicted. Okay, so, and that's the kind of balancing act that goes on.
Let's see, I'm checking down through the questions. I think that we've actually gotten through most of them. We're going to wind down soon. If people have other ideas or haven't spoken, I would like to interject. It's a good time to do that. I would hate to take a poll about whether we're more confused or less confused about entropy.
Supposed to be more confused.
Yes, I think I'm more confused now than I was when I started.
Maybe I have a simple question to go back to the beginning of the discussion. what is really the difference between neg entropy and just saying we reduce the a system which reduces its entropy? Why, I mean, is there a difference or?
Neg entropy is reducing the entropy.
That's all it is, yeah.
You know, in essence, think of, you have a can of gasoline sitting there, has tremendous potential to do things. You burn it, and according to the first law, it's still there. Didn't go away. The second law said, yes, but you can't do it again. That it has gone into another form that's no longer available. And so it's quite simple. So taking that to information, instead of the normal discussion about information, you talk about what's usable and what's not. So what's not is noise. So if certain professors are talking in a lecture hall, totally not understandable, we call that noise. But it may not be noise. It just depends on the time period and the context. Relative to the gasoline, there's no yes, but it's simply entropic processes have changed it to another state. It's no longer available to do things. And so that's why when this person, Georges Erosion, in this workshop was really hammered by, I think, a Swiss economist who really wanted to get into it, that he brought up the same argument. And what do you recommend I do as a person? And Erosion said, I recommend you economize. And the economist said, is that all? And Erosion said, yes, that's probably all you can do, and probably you won't do it. And that was the end of our Swiss economist, who went away feeling strange about Erosion. But economize means you try to produce those things that give you the most. That which is most valuable to life or support of life. Whereas the junk that's sort of noise and in the way, you know, using Stephen's comments as well as Jonathan, sort of, you know, it's noisy stuff that's in the way. And so Rosen was arguing, let's get rid of the noise. And also I tend not to relate to terms like recycling, sustainability, none of that, because second law of thermodynamics is not very happy about sustainability. It sort of says you can't go there. It isn't. Recycling really isn't. It's more marketing than actual recycling, et cetera, et cetera. But it involves humans, right, David? We've all met humans before.
To give a very concrete example, I used to earn my living as a systems analyst. And the question is, what do you do when you show up at the client's place Monday morning? One group of systems analysts looks around and says, what's wrong with this place? And another group of systems analysts looks around and asks, what is right? Where is the wealth? Where are the resources? Where are the strengths? The first group looks for entropy. The second group looks for negentropy.
Second group gets paid better.
Well, I'm sorry, again, speaking from experience, one of the best ways of getting fired is figuring out what's happening in a corporation. So yeah. My advice has always been to the students, you're going to figure out what's happening in about 15 minutes. And once you do it, shut up about it.
I try to avoid this by never doing what's called consulting for a company. I never consult, I only advise. And I explain to them the difference is, as an advisor, I'm allowed to swear at you. As a consultant, I'm not allowed to swear. Otherwise you won't pay me. And so let's do advisement. And so in my advisement, I then point out my pay scale and point out that no pay will come to me. It all goes to a charity. Either I select it or you select it. So my pay will always go to a charity, not to me. But I am allowed to swear when you do really dumb things, or we find really dumb things. And I tend to do well with the companies that do well. So for example, with one company, I was with them for 15 years as their senior advisor. And during that time, they went from 30 billion a year to 200 billion a year. And have done a lot of very interesting things worldwide. And we're still on good terms, and I'm still allowed to swear. And they have changed a lot, particularly relative to climate change. So that's, in essence, their number one issue. Whereas some other companies, there's no point. There's nothing to say or do. As a consultant, they'd probably pay you, but you'd leave shaking your head, wanting to know what that was all about. And the distinction I make between advisement and consulting seems understandable by them.
Okay, in the confusion that we've generated, I think I'm going to wind down this session. Thanks, David, for your commentary. And thanks, Stephen, for bringing in your commentary. For next month, we are working on something that's related to this. I'm currently working my way through humanism and the question as to whether humanism is helpful or not helpful to the world, in effect, as I'm looking at it. And so I'll be posting that and look forward to seeing you next month. Bye.
That's nice.
Thanks very much.
Thank you,
David.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Nice to meet everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. To you.
Very good. Thank you.